Well, hello everyone. This is Stephen Cohen from the beautiful metropolis of Colorado Springs, Colorado, here with episode 17 of the podcast, Quantitative Investigations. I'm in the dungeon of my new studio, which is really a temporary studio, because apparently I'm going to be without Goose the Engineer for a while. And I know everyone is going to be missing him and rather hear him than me. But such is life, isn't it? Today we're going to go over it's basically an index that I created called Cohen's Employment Index. Go figure. But there are a couple of interesting things that I did want to point out. Before we get to that, though, I wanted to update everyone on what's happening with all of these trials. And in particular, there's the civil trial filed by New York attorney Letitia James and is being tried in New York City. I'm not really sure. And actually, we're going to cover a few other things too regarding these trials and particularly trying to get President Trump kicked off the ballots. But I'm not really sure what this judge is thinking. I'm really not, because he's so blatantly violating the Constitution. And quite frankly, the state of New York has violated the Constitution, because supposedly there's a statute that allows the state to bring charges without a jury trial. And so, as everyone knows, we have this Judge Ergeron, I guess his name is, who is running this trial, supposedly has already determined guilt before the trial even started. And now we're just, quote unquote, at the penalty phase. But it's so blatantly, the whole trial is so blatantly unconstitutional. And you don't have to be a genius to figure it out. What do I mean? What do I mean? Well, if we turn to the Seventh Amendment of these United States Constitutions, the Seventh Amendment says this: in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, obviously this is $1787, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. That's pretty interesting. So, this trial brought by Letitia James is a civil trial. It is not a criminal trial. And that would fall under the suits at common law. And of course, the amount in controversy is going to be over $20, even in $1787. Although I could do that. I might be able to do that calculation. No, I can't. President Trump was entitled to a jury. Where's the jury? Oh, that's right. There is no jury. And this is why it's important to review source documents and not trust anyone. As a matter of fact, there's only one talking head, and I'm talking even in conservative news media. There's only one talking head. His name is Judge Andrew Napolitano. He's the only one, and this trial's been going on for months. He's the only one, and I heard him on Newsmax, the only one who actually referenced the Constitution and stated that this trial by judge for this civil matter is unconstitutional. He's the only one who mentioned it. And this was this past Friday, January 12th. He's the only one who mentioned it. Why is that? I mean, I don't watch Fox News anymore, so, you know, ever since Sean Hannity started asking his stupid questions of President Trump, I'm going to get to that, actually, in a second. Nobody mentioned it. Now, I knew this. I knew it was unconstitutional because of this very reason. Because I read the Constitution. Well, I used to read it once a year. I'm not going to say that I read it once a year anymore, but I read it. And I've read it, and I know where the provisions, in general, where provisions lie. This is ridiculous. But yet this judge is actually going to be able to keep his law license because that's the way things go. Clearly what he's doing is unconstitutional. And, of course, whatever verdict, if there's a guilty verdict of any kind, it's going to be vacated, probably not by the New York Supreme Court, definitely by the United States Supreme Court. So I wanted to point that out. The other thing I wanted to point out is, let's talk about efforts to eliminate President Trump off of state primary ballots. Ballots, right. And everyone cites the 14th Amendment. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the 14th Amendment has three parts. And what everyone cites, or I should say all of the corrupt media, what they cite is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Let me read. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress or elector of president and vice president or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any other state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each house, remove such disability. Interesting. So Congress can actually override an the inability or the disqualification by insurrection or rebellion. That I actually did not know. Now, here is what the corrupt news media intentionally overlooks. This is Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction equal protection of the laws. This section of the 14th Amendment gets abused and violated ad nauseum. Ad nauseum. It's pretty sick. But getting to the point at hand, you have to have a trial by jury, right? And that's according to, I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there, people. I'm going to get there. Where is it? Suits of law, Sixth Amendment, any criminal prosecution, the accused shall enjoy the right. Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, The accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. All right. By the way, because this is all in the male gender, that means women are not entitled to a trial by jury. I hope everyone realizes that I'm not serious. But I'm sure there might be some people out, well, not my listeners, but there's some people out there who would have taken me seriously. Okay, so the 14th Amendment guarantees due process. President Trump has never been charged with insurrection or rebellion. Never. Never been charged. And if he was charged, then he's guaranteed due process. And he's guaranteed a trial by jury under the Sixth Amendment. None of those have happened. If he hasn't been charged, tried, and found guilty of insurrection or rebellion, Section 3 of the Constitution is null and void. Null and void. Do you think any of these people care? Do you think the corrupt news media, the corrupt politicians, corrupt attorneys general, corrupt social media, do you think any of them care? No. No. Everybody should go back and read the Declaration of Independence and the list of grievances the United States had issued to England. Everybody should go back and read those. Because what we're doing right now is exactly why we fought the original American Revolution. I go back to something my youngest son said, when I talked about this at last episode. People fail to understand the ramifications of their decisions. I would like to add, sometimes people don't care about the ramifications of their decisions. But I would pose the question to you. Do Democrats, liberals, progressives not understand that the further you push people into tyranny, the greater the risk of rebellion? Do they not understand that? Do they not understand that most of the people who are going to rebel have and know how to use firearms? Do they not understand? I mean, look at what's happening in Texas this week. Texas seized the park and blocked federal border patrol agents from entering this park, I guess, where they were keeping illegal immigrants. Federal agents, I mean, the state of Texas is now constructing more border wall, and they are not allowing the feds to get involved. Where do you people think this is going to go? You have armed officers on both sides of this issue. Where do you people think this is going to go? I've been saying this for probably 15 years. To me, it was obvious at some point Texas was going to secede from the Union. Because I think a lot of people in Texas have had enough. And as Texas goes, so do many other states. This is just simply not going to end well. And it's because we have 50% of the population that are made up of people who either don't care or are ignorant to the fact that their political party is seeking to destroy the United States Constitution. It is a fact. You look at the behavior of the FBI and the CIA, NSA, We've spoken about this ad nauseum, and I'm probably not going to speak much about it anymore, though it depends on how serious of an issue comes up. This is not going to end well. When you have armed people on opposite sides of the coin who are going to be in constant aggravation of each other, somebody's going to blow a gasket. Somebody's going to blow a gasket. 1775, Lexington. The shot heard around the world of what I've been hearing and reading and hearing lately is that it was a mistaken shot. It was an accident. Is that true? I don't know. I don't think anyone really knows. But what I've been seeing on the History Channel, which is not really known for its accuracy, the shot heard around the world was an accident. It wasn't a misfire. It was an unintentional discharge. And look at what happened. When you have people antagonizing each other and everybody's armed, something's going to happen and it's not going to be good. And the tension in this country right now is such, it's not going to take a very big incident to really cause the proverbial poop to hit the fan. So, just want everyone to understand, we have a Constitution. The Constitution says things. We should all know what the Constitution says. We should all know what the Constitution says. Alrighty. So why don't we go ahead and move back to some more traditional quantitative investigations. You know, last episode we discussed unemployment numbers, what they mean, what they don't mean. So I want to talk about an employment statistic that I calculated myself called, go figure, Cohen's Employment Index. I know it's absolutely brilliant. You know, I couldn't have thought about it better myself. Anyway, so what I did, this is a number of years ago, probably, I don't know, 10 years ago, something in that order. I used what are called unadjusted numbers. So I did speak about seasonal adjustments in the last episode. And if you recall, a seasonal adjustment is one method of data smoothing. And I think I also explained that my preferred method of data smoothing is the moving average. It's more easily understood. And it's less subject to manipulation. But anytime you smooth data, you lose information. So the proper way to actually present smooth data is to have the smooth chart line on top of the actual data. So this way people can see the actual data and see the relationship between the smooth curve and the actual data curve. Because don't forget, when you smooth data, you interject error. Smoothing is a model. That's all it is a model. A moving average or a seasonal adjustment, they are both models. All models are wrong. A good modeler can tell you how wrong a model is, but all models are wrong. They are mathematical approximations that allow the user to understand trends. Because sometimes with data, it's hard to understand a trend. And oh, by the way, an average is a model. Anytime you average data, you actually introduce an error. So an average is a model, and that average comes with a variance and a standard deviation. If you just take the average of a set of numbers without understanding the standard deviation, the variance, and also there is a calculation for error, if you don't understand those other statistics and you're just looking at an average, then you don't understand the data set. And let me tell you, everyone does this. Because when news people talk about, generally news people, or when people in general are talking about average this, average that, sometimes there's no real understanding of the standard deviation, variance, and error of that average, or mean, as they say. So I promise you, if you don't understand the variance, standard deviation, or error of a mean, you do not understand what it is you're looking at. I promise. Anyway, so the proper way to present a smooth curve is to superimpose it onto the actual data curve. It's only then by doing that do you understand the relationship between the relationship between the smooth curve and the data. And then that gives you confidence that the smooth curve is representing the data to the point where you can draw conclusions. So what I did in calculating Cohen's employment index, I used three parameters: the employment population ratio, the number of part-time workers, and the number of full-time workers. And I'm not going to discuss how it was calculated because that's proprietary. All this information is available on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, although it's not the easiest to find, and this is what's really beginning to piss me off about the federal government. It seems over time, federal agencies are making it more difficult to find actual data. And that's really disturbing. 3 years ago, it used to be easy to find a lot of this data on the BLS website. And now it's becoming a little bit more difficult. And that's really, really upsetting. Now, the data that I haven't updated this in 3 years. Runs from the end of 1968 through, looks like the end of, did I get to 2020? Yeah, it looks like it looks like the beginning of 2020. So I haven't updated this through COVID. I think we're going to do that for next time. But I used to update this monthly, but quite frankly, life has taken hold and I'm busy with my job that actually pays me money. So, sue me. Anyway, so when I take a look at Cohen's Employment Index, what do I see? I see that from 1968 to 1972, that was a pretty big recession that I never hear about. I've never heard of a 1968 recession. But the more interesting thing and disturbing thing is that the index has never recovered to the 1968 level. Now, let me be clear about something. Economies are living, breathing things, right? Not necessarily in the literal sense, but certainly in the figurative sense. Economies, to me, are equivalent to living, breathing things. There are times when they don't feel well and times when they do. Recessions in an economy are natural. They are natural. They have to happen. You have periods of time when people are doing really well, they're buying stuff, and guess what? Once they have the stuff they need, they stop buying stuff. Our economy is a consumer-based economy, and I don't even know why anyone says that, because every economy is a consumer-based economy. If people aren't buying stuff, let's say everyone just sat on their money and no one bought stuff. Whether it's a capitalist economy, communist, whatever other kind of dictatorial economy, if people just sit on their hands and buy stuff, and I'm sorry, sit on their hands and don't buy stuff, no matter what economy you have, it will collapse. Every economy is a consumer-based economy. Even if you're trading, even if it's just a barter economy, right? If no one's even bartering for stuff, then there's no one gaining any wealth. Because what determines wealth? What determines what's worth something? How badly people want it. I don't get anyone sponsoring my podcast because I only have 230 listeners. However, interestingly enough, I was informed that my podcast is doing a whole lot better than some songs. Goose the Engineer informed me a little while ago that there are over 35 million songs that have no downloads. So I'm doing orders of magnitude better, well, infinitely actually. Infinitely better than those songs. But I don't have a million listeners. If I had a million listeners, I'd be making a lot of money off this podcast. But I'm not doing this for the money anyway because I have a regular professional job. Actually, most people would consider it an irregular professional job. So anyway, there are recession recovery cycles. And I'm just going to divert myself. According to the data, what you can see, there's the 1973 recession, and there was one, so it shows up in the data. There was a 1979 or 1980 recession, which is true, that shows up in the data. The 1989 to 90 recession, that shows up. The 2000 recession shows up, and the 2008 recession shows up. And again, unfortunately, I haven't updated this COVID, so I actually need to, and I'll talk about that in a following podcast episode. So you see these recession recovery cycles. It's natural. Nobody should panic in a recession. Nobody should panic. What you should be doing is during the bull market times or the bull times, you should be putting money away. Because then, when the recession bottoms out, you can hold yourself over to the recession bottoms out, and but most people aren't going to put away. And I don't have multiple years of expenses in cash worth of expenses in my bank account. I probably have like 6 months, but you certainly want to have cash reserves, and certainly if you're laid off in your if you're laid off from your job during a recession, you certainly need to cut back. But economies recover. And we've had recession recovery cycles since the beginning of our country. It happens. But the statistic in 1968, this 1968 thing, this really bothers me. It bothers me because no one talks about it. No one has ever mentioned this. And only the listeners of this podcast are going to be aware of this. We had a huge societal shift in 1968. And quite frankly, it may have started before then because some of the data that I use for my calculation, it just doesn't go before 1968. Something happened. And I don't know what it is. And I don't really have the time to look. The best I can figure is that in 1964 and 1965, the Great Societal Programs under Lyndon Johnson came into effect. So, and I'm on the History Channel. There's a History Channel. I'm on the History Channel website. Again, you got to be careful with anything that you read or hear on the History Channel, but it seems to be correct. In March of 64, the Office of Economic Opportunity and the Economic Opportunity Act was passed. And this was part of fighting poverty. This was part of Johnson's war on poverty. And the purpose of this was to actually put people back to work and train people so they can actually get to work. And also offer about 140,000 chance for 140,000 Americans to go to college who would otherwise not be able to afford it. So then there was Medicare and Medicaid. And that became law in 1964. And Medicare and Medicaid, you know, basically what they were trying to do is to provide medical insurance for two groups who were uninsured, the elderly and the poor. That was 64. Then there was Head Start and education reform. I didn't realize before I looked at this that the Head Start program actually started that long ago, but it was 1965. That was the Head Start program. And it guaranteed federal funding in education for school districts whose student majority was low income. Included funded preschool programs, school libraries, purchased school textbooks, and provided other special education services. Then there was the Housing and Urban Development Act in 1965. The National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities Act, 1965. The Water Quality Act was passed in 1965. Most people don't know, but actually, I think it was the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act was passed in 72 by Nixon, I believe. And that was Nixon, yeah, and that actually created the EPA. But then there was also welfare. And according to a website called federalsafetynet.com, and their tagline is, make poverty and welfare understandable. Boy, that seems to be a really weird tagline. Make it understandable. I'm not sure if they're talking about actual making poverty and welfare understandable or making programs understandable. But the first welfare programs, according to this website, the first welfare program was passed in 1930s, and it was a relatively small program passed in the New Deal. It really became expanded under Johnson. And one of the... let me see something here. It doesn't give a date when the original Welfare Act was passed. It just says over the years. That's kind of weird. Hold on a second. I'm going to try and find it. I'm not going to waste my time here. But in the 1960s, under Johnson, it was welfare was passed. And it was further expanded in 72, 75, 1990, and 1997. So, one thing that's curious, 72, Nixon. 75 was Ford. So, it's not like the expansion of the welfare program was only under Democratic presidents. Only one time was it reformed, in 1996. Those reforms were actually abolished by Obama. So, is it possible that the social programs drastically changed the employment condition and the employment situation in the United States? Is it possible? I'd have to say yes. I can't think of anything else, but I don't know. I don't know. It's only a guess. Because I've never heard anyone explain this. No one. Looking at the data also, starting from 1968, the biggest crash was that 2008 recession. That was a whopper. That was a whopper. Boy, I mean, it is deep and it is a sharp decline in the employment index. And still by 22, and that happened in 2008, still by January of 2020, still by January 2020, the index did not recover to that pre-2008 recession level. It still hasn't recovered. Now, again, I haven't updated this in 3 years, so I don't know what the COVID curve looks like. But it looks like that 2008 recession was another watershed moment. Now, does that mean that it's never going to recover to the pre-2008 recession levels? I don't know. You know, for example, the 1990 recession, when that finally recovered, that actually got up to the peak, which is right before the 2000 recession, is higher than the peak of the previous recovery. So it is possible that the employment condition will exceed at some point the 2008 level. But I don't know. It hasn't gotten there yet. And it actually looks like another recession was about to start, because the moving average, this is really interesting. It looks like around January 2020 that we're hitting another peak, and that we might have been starting in another recession, because the data looks like it's about to peak. That's the other interesting thing about this index. The peaks are not flat. They are actual peaks, which means when we hit our top employment index, it doesn't last very long. Now, neither do the valleys. So really, for the most part, it's really interesting. Our economy is in a constant state of flux. Yeah, and by economy, I really mean our employment. Our employment condition in this country is in a constant state of change. Constant. And that's really interesting, because it doesn't seem that way when you're actually just living your life. It seems like things are going smooth, and all of a sudden it bottoms out, and then it comes back, goes smooth again. There are no flat lines on this curve. There are no purely horizontal lines in this curve. There are actually no lines that even closely resemble horizontal lines on this curve. That's pretty cool. That's something else you don't hear. The employment condition in this country, and it's probably most countries too, constantly in flux. It's constantly changing. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to update this and then present that with the update on the next episode. But I think at this point, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to call it a day. Thank you very much for listening. Again, this is Stephen Cohen for Quantitative Investigations, episode 17.